At 9 o'clock.
That's fine. We are going to tape record the interview. We mentioned that.
That's not a problem.
Okay. So I guess we might as well just start. My name is Greg Feldberg. I'm with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, which was set up by Congress to investigate the causes of the financial crisis. I'm here with Art Wilmarth, Ron Borzakowski, and Adam Paul from the staff here. And Professor, could you just go ahead and say your name and describe your position and your background?
Yes, I'm Professor Frederick at Michigan, and I'm a professor. I'm the Alfred Lerner Professor of Banking and Financial Institutions at the Graduate School of Business, Columbia University. I'm also a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research, and I was a former governor of the Federal Reserve from September 2006 through August 2008.
Okay. I think you had also previously worked at the Federal Reserve?
Yes, I had. I was an executive vice president and director of research at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York from, I think it's September 1994 through August of 1997.
Okay, and just while we're just getting the background in, while you're at the Federal Reserve Board, can you tell us what committees or specific assignments you had?
I was a Consumer and Community Affairs Committee. I was on the Supervision and Regulation Committee, and I was, in those cases, I was not the chair, but I was chair of the, I'm not remembering the exact, it was the chair in terms of the committee that oversees economic research. I can't remember the economic affairs, something like that.
Okay. Great. Well, so thank you. I guess we'd like to start these calls off just with a very broad question. In your view, what were the main causes of the financial crisis?
I think one of the things that way to think about this is, in the sense, first of all, it's a two-phase crisis. The first phase is the subprime mortgage crisis, and then the second phase is what happened in the fall of 2008. The way I look is to describe this as a rogue wave phenomenon. What do we mean by rogue wave? Because many of you are sailors, so I'm on the Hudson River. Every once in a while, you don't see any boats, and all of a sudden you see a big wave come up. What happens is all of a sudden there's a combination of little waves that end up piling to one big one. And in a sense, that's what happened here. There were multi causes. In terms of the initial phase, basically this is a very classic financial crisis. If you study these things, which in fact I've done a lot of research over the years, that it starts with a financial innovation, which is securitization and the ability to quantify people's credit scores, so you can now bundle up their mortgages into securities. And as a result, you end up with this originate-to-distribute model, where people originate mortgages and then distribute them. And it has a key problem from an economic viewpoint. We talk about this as an agency problem, which is that the ultimate holders of the securities have the people who originate the securities do not have the incentives to make sure that the ultimate holders of the securities will get paid back. So that's a very key factor that starts off this crisis or problem. Also very important is that you had a huge inflow of liquidity we were in a very unique kind of situation where poor countries like China were shipping tremendous amount of money to advanced countries because their financial systems were so weak that they were better off sending their money to places like the United States rather than keeping it in their own country. And so the system was awash with liquidity, which helped lower long-term interest rates. This is what Alan Greenspan called the conundrum. That was an important factor as well. Very important factor also, which was particularly important later down the road, was the compensation incentives for Wall Street. And this is basically not the very top people who actually lost a ton of money when this happened. People like Dick Fuld and Jimmy Cain lost a lot of money. But for the people somewhat lower down the food chain, where they were able to engage in something that's very akin to a carry trade. The person who's talked about this, you probably may have interviewed him, is Raghu Rajan. I don't know if you interviewed him, but you should have. because he's really, I think, the person who most got this right in terms of discussion of the crisis. And the problem is that in this kind of a carry trade, what's happening is that you're a carry trade. Technically, is when you in fact borrow in one currency at a very low interest rate and then lend in another currency at a high interest rate. While that's happening, you're booking a lot of profits, and if your compensation is based on that, you're making a lot of money. But of course, the reason why the interest rate is higher in one country is because there's a risk that the currency will depreciate, a big tail risk. And in fact, that kind of problem was really very, very evident in a serious way. The classic example of it, by the way, is AIG, where they were issuing these insurance contracts, these credit default swaps. They were booking all these profits, making a lot of money, but of course, and therefore getting compensated for it in bonuses and everything else. But then, of course, the problem is that if the casualty actually occurs, the catastrophe occurs, now you're in big trouble. And so, a factor which I consider to be relevant but not critical. Let's see. I just got an email from Dave Kirkerson. Is he on? Yeah, he's on. Good.
Right, I'm here.
Another factor that I think is a factor, but I would not put as one of the most important ones, but is emphasized by many, many people, is the Federal Reserve's low interest rate policy in the 2003-2005 period. I think it did play a role, but a small role. I would consider the other factors to be more important, but not saying that the Federal Reserve's low interest rate policy didn't have anything to do with it. Another issue that's very common is that when you have financial innovations and new products, that sometimes, that frequently the regulation tends to fall behind, and this was the case here as well, that regulators didn't get it right. I should point out, by the way, that sometimes regulators do get some of these things right, and we do understand it, but either the politics, whatever interferes with the process. So let me give two examples. One example I remember when I was at the Federal Reserve Board is that we put in a guidance for commercial lending, commercial real estate lending for banks. And if we hadn't done so, I think that the situation in the smaller community banks would have been much worse and not very good in any case. There was a lot of yelling and screaming that occurred, but one thing is you never get credit for doing something right. You only get beaten up for the fact that when things go wrong. Another example, which by the way I think is important, and people actually mention this. The Wall Street Journal loves to mention this as the cause of the crisis, but I don't buy it. Although I think it is again another factor, is the GSEs, Fannie and Freddie, that the economics profession for years, including myself, I can't tell you how many editions of the textbook I had a discussion of Fannie and Freddie and said they were an accident waiting to happen that was going to cost the taxpayer a hell of a lot of money. That the economics profession almost unanimously was very critical of what was going on there, but the Congress absolutely refused to put in appropriate regulation and appropriate constraints on Fannie and Freddie. Although I don't think that's a major factor in the financial crisis, I think it does have some impact. Again, I would put it as a lesser impact rather than one of the most important. It turns out that will cost the federal government more than the taxpayer more than anything else. So that the numbers that I've seen indicate that the TARP is not going to lose much money. AIG, there'll be some losses of money. Bear Stearns, very small amount of losses. The huge losses to the taxpayer are going to be Fannie and Freddie. And all of that was predictable, and that was just a bad political process that led to it. So I think one of the ways of saying this is there's a lot of different things to blame. It's not one factor, and all of these, when they combined, kaboom, we had a disastrous crisis. And I should say that there's a two-phase crisis. The subprime crisis is initial phase. A small part of the capital markets losses on the order of $500 billion. Because it was only $1.5 trillion sector. But then what happens is that when you get to the Lehman Brothers episode, which is after I left the Federal Reserve, it revealed how serious some of these other problems were. So many people talk about Lehman Brothers as being the the key thing that really drove this into a major crisis. I actually take a somewhat different view. I think it's more than just Lehman Brothers. Lehman Brothers was a trigger, but actually I think very bit as important was the immediate subsequent event of the AIG, breaking of the buck of the Reserve Management Fund, and then the struggle to get TARP passed. The reason those are so important is that Lehman Brothers revealed there was a problem, but actually Lehman Brothers, it was well understood in the markets that Lehman Brothers was the most vulnerable of all the investment banks, and many of the counterparties knew this. What happened is when Lehman Brothers went belly up, it revealed that this very large carry trade element of what was going on in terms of financial firms was very prevalent, and that was the AIG episode. AIG revealed that the rot was much worse in the system than anybody had ever anticipated. And then similarly, the same thing was true of the reserve primary fund, where there's a lot of irony because the person who ran that fund was actually the originator of money market funds in the early 1970s. So and then the TARP process was very highly problematic because the Treasury Keynes proposal to Congress was only a three-page document with aspects which were very much not the typical way that Americans do things, because I know some of you are lawyers in the United States. If you say to somebody you can't sue, that's like un-American. In the case that there was an issue about whether, in fact, people could sue the Treasury in terms of TARP, clearly there was an issue of accountability. The Congress was very upset about this, and then the initial TARP bill got voted down. And when it finally got passed, it was passed with a whole set of provisions that indicated some of the dysfunctionality of Congress. The most famous one I remember is the subsidy for wooden toy arrows. And that actually weakened the confidence that the American public had in terms of the government's ability to handle this crisis. And those combination of events are what tipped us into something that was really horrendous. So it's a multifaceted problem. That shouldn't surprise us because this is a once-in-a-70-year phenomenon. So the Greenspan called this a once-in-a-100-year tsunami. And that fits very much with this rogue wave type viewpoint, which is it was multi-causal. That's all of these things combined, and kaboom, we ended up with an absolute disaster.
So can we go back? I mean, you mentioned a lot of different causes. Can we go back and see, I guess, ask the question, what was knowable and what wasn't knowable? And I think you mentioned, like, the first thing you mentioned was securitization, and you said there was an agency problem that people were well aware of. Was that all securitization, or is that special to private?
No, hold it. I didn't say that there were some people that were aware of it. So this is Raghu Rajan's famous Jackson Hole paper, which got it spot on.
Mm-hmm.
But people didn't fully understand that. I mean, one of the things I think that I find very troubling about the discussion of this crisis is the view that everybody knew it was going to happen and then people behaved badly. I think that's just absolutely incorrect. That if everybody knew it was going to happen, it wouldn't have happened, because people don't go out to try to lose money. They don't go out to make bad investments. That there were people who did get it right. I should say there are economists who have become very famous for saying there was going to be crisis, but their analysis was wrong. Raghu's analysis, I think, was spot on. He's one of my heroes in this crisis. But it was still hard to understand how serious this problem was until it actually got revealed. So I think it's very dangerous for people to say that everybody knew this was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Some people did and had it right, but in general, when you see bubbles of the type that we had in the housing market, when you see credit booms of the type that we had, if the majority of people understood that this was a problem, then in fact it wouldn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
So the only case where I say that I think that that's not completely true is when we have a political process that drives something. Fannie and Freddie were clearly an accident waiting to happen. Certainly among economists, it was, if you asked any economist who had thought about it all, would Fannie and Freddie be a problem, the answer would have been yes.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because the political process actually failed us in in that case. But clearly one of the problems of the political process is that there's a view that we should have a chicken in every pot, that everybody should own their own homes, and the way to do that is to encourage them to go into debt. And that turns out to be very bad policy, and was bad policy for a long time. And there were repeated warnings about Fannie and Freddie, both from economists, from people at the Federal Reserve, and so forth. So that's a case where I'd say it was well known among economists, but that doesn't mean that it was agreed to by all parties, because otherwise I don't think the politicians wanted Fannie and Freddie to blow up and cost the taxpayer the kind of money they're talking about. It was just a lack of understanding. Okay. So I think we need to be very careful on that point.
Okay. So when it comes to the agency problem, is that a problem to all types of securitization, or was there something unique in the way it was done in the mortgage market in this time period?
Well, so I think what's key is, no, it's not all securitization. The problem here is that when you get new financial innovations, over time, when you have financial innovations, they actually tend to make the world better off. But frequently, so for example, subprime lending in itself is not a bad thing. Indeed, if it's done right, it's actually very beneficial because it allows for the democratization of credit. And by the way, the subprime lending was very much supported by people in Congress before this crisis because it allowed poor people to get access to credit. The problem is that when you have a new innovation, sometimes the business model is not completely right. People don't realize how serious the agency problems are. And that was very, very much a problem in this context. So subprime lending done, and originate to distribute done right so that the incentives of the originators are the same as the incentives of the people who actually ultimately hold the securities would actually be a beneficial thing. So securitization is something that I see in general as being potentially very helpful and an innovation that makes capital markets more efficient. But in this particular case, that people didn't think it through properly. They thought that housing prices would never go down. We had never seen a decline in housing prices of this magnitude in the post-war era, not even close. And everybody thought that everything was going to be fine because these subprime lenders, borrowers, would be able to refinance their mortgages as their housing prices increased. And also, very importantly, people didn't realize about the interconnectedness in the system. So I think the issue here is that it would be a huge mistake, again, to think that securitization is inherently a bad thing, similarly to the view that it would be very, very bad for people to think that the derivatives are a very bad thing. These things actually, particularly when they get mature and people work out these problems, they actually are things that help increase the efficiency of the capital markets. On the other hand, when you have a problem, you've got to fix it, and that means that you have to worry about incentives, you have to worry about getting regulation right in order to make sure that the innovation actually is beneficial, not harmful. And again, the history of financial crisis really establishes this. So, for example, one of the great innovations that has made the world incredibly better off is the invention of the corporation that issues common stock. And issues different kinds of stock. That's an incredibly great innovation. The modern world could not operate without it because you could not have large-scale enterprises without it. On the other hand, when it was invented, they didn't understand the business model completely, and as I understand it, if I'm correct, that the South Street, the invention of this corporate stock, this corporate structure, was in fact part of what happened during the South Street, South Sea, whatever that bubble is in the 18th century. Mm-hmm. So the history of financial crises is replete with these examples of innovations which eventually will be beneficial, but when they first come out, they don't quite get them right, and they don't solve the agency problems, and they then lead to disaster.
Okay. Can we switch gears and talk about your time at the Fed? And I guess the first question would be, you got there in 2006, Was the housing bubble that was going on a major topic of discussion?
Well, you have to remember, by the time I got there, the housing bubble started to pop. Mm-hmm. So, because housing prices reached a peak in 2006 and were already starting to decline. So what I would say about this issue is that there was widespread discussion among all economists whether there was a housing bubble or not, and there were differing views on it. That there were some people who felt that housing prices were consistent with fundamentals, and there were others who did not think it was consistent with fundamentals. So that I don't think there was any common view inside the Fed at the time, that I think there would be many different viewpoints.
Now, if we had a crystal ball in 2004 or 2005, which was before you were at the Fed, but if the Fed had a crystal ball and knew that a 25-30% nationwide decline in housing prices was going to be coming along, do you think the Fed would have done something differently?
Well, I think surely the Fed and many other organizations would have done things differently. I think that clearly, in terms of consumer regulation, which the Federal Reserve was involved in, there would have been a recognition that the underwriting standards for mortgage loans were problematic, and that people, that households, did not have sufficient information to make informed decisions. So the Federal Reserve actually did implement a set of regulations, consumer regulations, later on to make unfair and deceptive practices, to declare certain things as unfair and deceptive practices and disallow them. Certain kind of, for example, incentives of brokers to get people into mortgages and get paid for that. Again, you have to look at the exact regulations the Fed passed. There were requirements to make that the originators had to do their best to make sure that the person who was given a mortgage would actually be able to pay it back. That was done, and done after the fact, when it was too late. Part of the reason why it was too late was because it wasn't sufficiently realized how big a problem this was earlier. So clearly there's an issue of regulation in that context. There's also clearly an issue of regulation of financial institutions that ex post. There's no question that that allowing investment banks to have very low amounts of capital was a mistake, and that was not the Federal Reserve, by the way. One thing that's very important to recognize in this context, which always I find remarkable, is that there's a frequently attacks on the Federal Reserve for its mistakes in terms of regulation, and there clearly were mistakes. But the institutions that actually blew us up, none of them were the ones that were regulated and supervised by the Federal Reserve. Bear Stearns, AIG, Bear Stearns was supervised by the SEC. AIG, much less clear, because insurance companies have very complicated regulation in terms of states and so forth. But so clearly there's a whole bunch of issues in terms of regulation that ex post now we'd like to deal with. And in fact, there's a tremendous amount of research going on. I'm a member of something called the SQAM, a working group on financial regulation. We just published a book with Princeton University Press on this topic, where we talk about a lot of things that need to be done differently than they were done before. There's an issue about monetary policy, whether the Federal Reserve would have done something different in terms of monetary policy. I think that this is an open issue. However, again, because I do not think that the Federal Reserve monetary policy was a key factor, I don't think that it's been a big change in Federal Reserve policy would have made a big difference here. So ex post, would we like to do things differently? Absolutely. There's just no question that we would have liked to have done a lot of things differently, but it's much easier if you have a crystal ball or to be a Monday morning quarterback than to deal with the situation ex ante.
Okay. Can you talk us through the crisis, from the point of view of the Federal Reserve Governor, really starting in July 07 when the first liquidity crisis started? And then your experience really goes all the way through, so I'd really like to know what you learned about interconnectedness, what the Fed, kind of what the reaction was at the Fed to those developments.
Well, I think that the Fed did act quite aggressive. I'm going to be partisan here. I was an insider, and I also had a particular viewpoint when I was inside. We came very close to having a depression in this country. And the Federal Reserve took extremely aggressive actions happens during this period. I was there for only the first phase, but I should tell you that to be full disclosure, I was actually a very strong advocate of being aggressive, and in fact was pushing for the Federal Reserve to be more aggressive than the average FOMC participant was pushing. So it just tells you where my bias is. And my view is that that if we had not seen the kind of actions that the Federal Reserve took, and also even though the TARP was incredibly flawed, and I'm very critical of many elements of the way it was actually executed, which actually created some real problems, without that those government bailouts, again, I think that that we would have had a much, much, much worse situation. So that doesn't excuse some of the mistakes, but on the other hand, I think that that's extremely important. So the Federal Reserve, first of all, the issue of conventional policy and then non-conventional monetary policy. After the August 7th blow-up with BNP Paribas, or I'm not pronouncing that right, but my language skills are poor. The Federal Reserve immediately acted that we lowered the discount rate premium over the federal funds target from 100 basis points to 50. That I personally would have liked to have seen us even do more at that point. In September FOMC meeting, despite the fact that the economy had a tremendous amount of momentum that was growing very strongly up until then in the third quarter, and also that we had very high inflation, which was well above anybody's view of what an appropriate inflation rate was. Despite that, the Federal Reserve started to lower interest rates. So this is actually extremely unusual behavior on the part of the Federal Reserve. Federal Reserve was very aggressive in terms of easing interest rates, and I was a very strong advocate of that. This is in the public record because of David Wessel's book. In December 2007, I felt very strongly that the Federal Reserve needed to cut interest rates even more rapidly. This was not where the committee was heading. I even contemplated its dissent, but decided that would be problematic from the point of view of the market's view of the Federal Reserve, because it's very rare that governors dissent. And also, you stay part of a team if you have confidence in the leadership, and I had tremendous confidence in the leadership of the chairman Bernanke. Immediately after that, I think that was a mistake, because in January, then the Federal Reserve started cutting rates very, very aggressively and continue to do so. So monetary policy actually was very unusual, very preemptive, and I think very important, and indeed, I would argue, was effective. I have a paper in the American Economic Review in May of 2009 where I actually refused the view that monetary policy was ineffective during that period. In fact, I argued that it was even more effective. The problem, however, was that the shock was so large that the monetary policy just couldn't countervail how big a shock this was. Again, this is the once in a 100-year tsunami that Greenspan talked about. The Fed also pursued a whole set of non-conventional policies, basically intervening in the credit markets. They did all sorts of what we call lender of last resort activities. As I mentioned, this included lowering the interest rate on discount loans, but also included very creative measures when the discount window wasn't working as effectively as would have been hoped. So this is, for example, the TAF. And then, you have all these acronyms, TALF, TAF, PDCF. We could go on and on. I think these actions were very aggressive. They were extremely controversial. The Federal Reserve was very criticized for them. They've also resulted in very serious attacks on the Federal Reserve's independence, because the Federal Reserve basically has gone into the realm that, in fact, central banks typically don't go into, engagement in and intervention in private credit markets. This also, by the way, included the asset purchase program, which was done after I left, by the way. all of these, I think, were extremely important, very, very helpful in terms of changing expectations and taking away some of the macroeconomic risk in the economy. I was a very strong advocate of this. I gave a speech in January 10th of 2008 where I actually outlined why I thought the Fed needed to be more aggressive in terms of managing this crisis. And shortly thereafter, the Fed actually got much more aggressive. Clearly, part of the reason I gave that speech was because I felt that the Fed was not sufficiently aggressive and needed to rethink the way it did policy. But the Fed really did do that. So, as I said, and there was a calculation that was done here. There was no question, I'm sure, that taking these aggressive actions were going to subject the Fed to criticism. That was very much something that, of course, happened later on, and with potentially some disastrous situations, I think, not only for the Federal Reserve, but also for the ability for the Federal Reserve to do monetary policy effectively. So, for example, this is the Ron Paul bill, and also there were some provisions in the original Dodd bill that were very problematic. But I think the Fed showed great courage in this context, and Ben Bernanke showed great courage. From my viewpoint, did the Fed get everything right? Absolutely not. But what we did not do was we did not sit as deer in the headlights and allowed a major financial disruption to lead to a depression. And there were, you know, part of this is lessons learned. One of the things, reasons we were lucky was to have a chairman and also other members of the FOMC, and I do include myself in this, who had been students of financial crisis history and understood that when you have a financial crisis, that it's a very different environment and you have to act very aggressively and very quickly. And that's exactly what the Fed did. And so did the Fed get everything right? Absolutely not. But on the other hand, when you look at other episodes in history, so for example, you look at what the Federal Reserve did in the Great Depression era, if you look at what the Bank of Japan and the policymakers in Japan did when the bubble burst in Japan, I think history is going to view the Fed as having done actually on net an extremely good job and a courageous job. And even though right now the Fed is under a lot of attack, I think partially because many of the players people would like to get at, they can't get at now because, you know, there's a new administration, the old the people are no longer in Washington, and people like Ben Bernanke still are there. I think history is going to judge the Fed very favorably. That's my view. Now, of course, it's a somewhat biased view because I was part of the decisions up until August of 2008 that pursued these aggressive decisions. And as I pointed out, I was somebody who is an advocate both inside and also outside in terms of my speeches for us to be extremely aggressive. And I think that these measures helped tremendously. Did they prevent us from having the worst recession in the post-war period? Absolutely not. When you get a shock of this magnitude, avoiding something much worse still deserves a lot of credit.
Professor Mishkin, this is Ron Borzikowski. It's good to talk to you again. So a lot of the actions you just discussed at the Fed they're fundamentally liquidity actions, right? The first were expansion of the discount window into the commercial banking sector, and then with the PDCF and others, extension of liquidity, and as you put it, lender of last resort activities to, you know, it's now become the shadow banking system, the money markets more generally. The Commission has spoken to some people who feel the argument is laid out that the reason these may not have worked, and this may be the topic of your May 2009 piece in the AER, is that it wasn't a liquidity crisis. That this was fundamentally about counterparty risk, and that by failing to recognize that's the reason these things didn't work, and the crisis continued for 18 months, eventually getting us to September of 2008. What's the evidence sort of against that?
Well, I wouldn't say the evidence is against that. There's no question that this was not just a liquidity crisis, but there was also solvency issues. So that I don't disagree with that aspect at all. And in fact, it's part of the reason that this crisis, that this shock here was so huge. I've argued in a lot of speeches that I've given afterwards that the shock that we experienced, the financial shock that we experienced, was actually worse and more complicated than one that caused the Great Depression. And that's why, in fact, I think the actions of the fact that we didn't have a depression is good news. But the shock was massive, and it was well beyond just a pure liquidity shock, which would have been made much, much easier for the standard liquidity actions to solve the problem. And in fact, the Federal Reserve didn't just do liquidity actions, because it wasn't just things where they were lending with to banks in the usual lend of last resort mode. They were actually involved in a lot of lending facilities which were much, much more direct interventions in private credit markets. The Federal Reserve also engaged in purchases of private securities. They ended up with $1.25 trillion of MBS securities. And so this is an indication that this shock was huge. So where I disagree with this viewpoint is not that the problem was well beyond the liquidity problem, because I think indeed it was, is the view that the Federal Reserve's actions were, in fact, ineffective. So, I have to tell you, I have tremendous disagreements with John Taylor's views on this crisis. And actually, I should tell you, John Taylor and Alan Meltzer are very, very close friends of mine, and yet I disagree with a lot of their analysis of what happened here during the crisis. And there's tremendous debate on this. The research, in fact, I have a paper that I'm just preparing for the Journal of Economic Perspectives, in which I talk about these actions and evaluate them. And my reading of the research on this is that these actions were indeed effective. The conventional monetary policy actions, I've already argued in that May piece, was effective, but eventually could no longer be effective when nominal interest rates hit the floor of zero, the so-called zero-lower bound problem. But on the other hand, when you get to these non-conventional measures, the research, I think, shows that these, in fact, were quite helpful. And indeed, there's an additional issue of expectations that's very important, so-called management of expectations. It's very much a feature of discussions about optimal monetary policy. So Mike Woodford of Columbia is one of the key advocates of this. The fact that a central bank is taking aggressive actions to take away some of the macroeconomic risk in the economy can be very important to prevent a vicious a downward spiral. And again, I think that I really disagree very strongly with the view that John Taylor, for example, has taken, that we would have been much better off if the Federal Reserve just followed the Taylor rule and did not do these actions. That I actually think that if that policy had been followed, the possibility that we could have had a depression with unemployment about 15% could have been much, much higher. So don't take the view that the first part, that it was more the liquidity crisis, as then supporting the second part, which is that the actual actions that the Federal Reserve took were ineffective. I just disagree with that. The way of thinking about what the Fed did is they weren't just credit liquidity actions by themselves, but they had this element of what the chairman referred to as credit easing. So I actually do not think the quantitative easing is very effective. It's just expanding the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve is not the way that you solve these problems, but it's the way you expand the balance sheet. And the Federal Reserve was expanding the balance sheet. The balance sheet expansion was a result of actions that were taken to, in fact, make sure the markets became functional again. So I do think this was a liquidity crisis. I don't know if you've spoken to Gary Gorton, he's got a very well-known paper about how this was like a classic run, but not on the banking system, but on the shadow banking system, which had liquidity elements, but there clearly were solvency elements as well. There were all those people who shouldn't have gotten mortgages who couldn't pay them back, and then the securities that were based on them had very sharp decreases in values, and of course that led to holes in terms of financial institutions' balance sheets. So there's no question in my mind that it's both a liquidity crisis and a solvency crisis. But in fact, that us from having a depression.
What's because in September of 2008 we didn't. I mean, because of the, in your view, and I think in many people's views, because of the aggressive actions in September of 2008, the money market facilities, the commercial paper facilities, and eventually the TARP and SCAP after that, we never got to the Great Depression phase. What does the other path look like? Quickly, if you can describe sort of what would have gotten us to 25% unemployment? Because that's something the American people haven't seen, and a lot of people don't believe we were on that path, and it's helpful.
I don't think we would have 25% unemployment.
15 or 18. I mean, whatever, a much more severe economic situation than we found ourselves in, even with the dire situation.
So if in fact you didn't see these aggressive actions, that the aftermath of the Lehman AIG Reserve Primary Fund episode would have seen a much more serious seizure of the financial market. But one of the things that's very important to recognize about financial crises is how nonlinear they are. So in my research on financial crises, that's the way I define them. I basically define a financial crisis as a nonlinear disruption to information flows. So it has this element of going over the cliff. And in some sense, we had it going over the cliff, but there's a question of how far you fall, whether you fall 15, 20 feet and you really hurt yourself bad, or you fall 100 feet and you die. So I think that the possibility and potential for multiple failures of major institutions would have been very high if these actions hadn't been taken. So think about the major banks, which had enough problems as it was, if they actually went belly up along the lines of Lehman. And one of the things that's also very important here to recognize is a big problem before this crisis was the lack of a resolution authority. It is true that there might have been other steps that could have been taken to save Lehman, which did not require resolution authority, but they would have been very complicated and very dangerous for both either the government or the central bank to get involved in. One of the big problems, I would say, of not having resolution authority, which I think a lot of people do not understand, is so that people will say, oh, if there's a resolution authority, it actually makes too big to fail an even bigger problem. I would argue that the opposite is actually the case. When you do not have a resolution authority, then, in fact, you have the following game of chicken that large financial institutions can play. And in fact, when you read what was going on with Lehman Brothers, I think this really is very clear, which is that a large financial institution can say to the government, you have two choices: either you bail me out, or you send me into bankruptcy. And therefore, I'm not going to take the steps to shore up my balance sheet position. Lehman was very reluctant to, in fact, raise capital, even though it was being pushed to do so, because it would dilute the shareholders. On the other hand, I think Lehman was playing a game of chicken, and they lost. They thought they were going to get bailed out, and they weren't. And of course, the fact that they didn't protect themselves when they could have, particularly after the Bear Stearns episode, when the writing really was much clearer that in fact they needed to raise capital, is just an indication of how dangerous it is to not give the government the tools to basically, so not to give the government a choice, which is in between either a bailout or alternatively going to bankruptcy. And this problem actually is even more severe now. I don't think the government's going to tolerate another Lehman, and financial institutions understand this, and that's one of the reasons why having this new resolution authority work well is going to be very critical to making sure that we don't have this kind of episode happen again.
So before Bear Stearns, what was the view at the Federal Reserve about the investment banks? Was there an idea that the failure of an investment bank would have systemic consequences?
Well, I got to tell you, the thing that's remarkable about the Bear Stearns episode is how shocking and surprising it was. And let me explain what was shocking and surprising about it, which is that Bear Stearns, if you looked at their balance sheet, They had very little unsecured lending. So they looked. Usually, what we worry about in the balance sheet is that you have unsecured lending, because then people, if people worry about the health of the firm, they'll run on the firm, and then you have a liquidity crisis that can spill over into a solvency crisis. In the case of Bear Stearns, their borrowing was basically all in the repo market. It was secured secured borrowing, and in fact, in the repo market, the way you view this is that if the repo market is working very well, it solves information problems. Again, if you want to read about this issue of collateral, it's in my textbook, in the ninth edition of my money and banking textbook. That what you do is you set up an arrangement where you have a collateral, and if there's collateral and the collateral is very easy to value, then in fact you worry less about how good a firm it is. So you solve the information problems that way, and in fact that allows a lot of borrowing to take place. In fact, most borrowing is done under a collateralized loan contract. Well, that's exactly what the repo market is. Repos are you take out a loan and then you have a collateral. It's structured in a slightly different way, but in effect, it's a collateralized loan. And there's a haircut on the collateral, so that you make sure that if the collateral is valued at a dollar, that in fact you don't allow borrowing of a dollar. You allow borrowing, let's say, of 95 cents. So you have what's called a 5% haircut. The problem is that I think people did not recognize is that in a systemic situation, and when somebody's large enough, if they default on their loans, the collateral may no longer be good collateral anymore. Because if they default, and in this case, think of Bear Stearns going belly up. Bear Stearns goes belly up, then there are all these people who are holding Bear Stearns paper. And then what they do is they take the collateral back, but in fact many of the people who were then taking this collateral back would have had to sell it, because in some cases they weren't allowed to hold that kind of collateral because it was not classified as a collateral they could hold. Well, if you start selling collateral, you get fire sales, and if you get fire sales, the collateral falls in value and you may not know what the value is. So in that situation, what can happen then is that you all of a sudden realize that your collateral is no good. Now you worry about the health of the company that's on the other side of the repo, and you run on them. And this is basically the story that Gordon and Metrick talk about in terms of this run in the shadow banking system. This was really something that people just did not recognize sufficiently, because the view was you're protected because you have this good collateral, and not realizing that if somebody is big enough and all the collateral starts being sold, that we're no longer in a situation where they can value it correctly. And in fact, what you see is a downward spiral where the collateral falls in value, then in fact people raise haircuts, which means you can borrow less, so you have to sell even more collateral, and the result is that you get even more fire sales and a collapse in values, which means that you actually have a lending, this implosion process of an adverse feedback loop. So Bear Stearns was a remarkable event. It really surprised everybody, and indeed was much more surprising to the markets than the failure of Lehman Brothers.
So, I mean, the Fed announced the term
security lending. I do have to make this phone call, so let's put this on hold for a few minutes, if you could.
Sure, we'll put this on mute, and we'll wait until we hear from you.
Well, I don't know how to go back on mute. I'm just going to make the phone call and come back. So,
okay.
Whatever you want to do is fine. But I don't know how to put my thing on mute.
Okay, thanks.
I'll be back in just a few minutes, hopefully.
Okay.
I have another call come in. I just have to deal with this stuff. I have to deal with it at 9 o'clock. So, but we're fine.
I very much appreciate it. I thought we would be totally over by 9. So it's nice to have you back for a little longer.
So I guess we take back time.
Yep.
So we had just started to talk about the repo market and Bear. And I guess my first follow-up question, and I know the other guys have others, was the Fed's term securities lending facility, which was aimed at addressing that kind of problem. I mean, how long had you been talking about that, and to what extent did it envision the kind of crisis that we had?
Which facility?
The TSLF.
Okay, so all of that stuff occurred after Bear. So remember that, as I said, Bear was a big surprise. The Fed operated very quickly, but for example, we put in the PDCF was put in after Bear, basically to shore up the system. Once Bear went, there was a clear issue that, in fact, there might be problems for our other investment banks. So the Federal Reserve actually put in lending facilities. Prior to this, the Federal Reserve was not able to lend to. We have a Federal Reserve lawyer. He may actually know all the rules, but the legal stuff was always very complicated.
But the term securities lending facility was announced before Bear, and the way some people in the market understood it was that the Fed was announcing this program, and the Fed must be worried about Bear.
Oh, okay. This is something I just don't remember the exact sequencing.
Okay.
So clearly there was a whole bunch of things going on at around the same time. When I say there was a surprise, it's not that there wasn't a sense that there was a problem shortly beforehand, mm-hmm. but it was not something that was anticipated months beforehand. That's the key point I wanted to make.
If I told you in the fall of 07 that an investment bank could fail, was the thinking at the Fed that the system could handle it? We had handled Drexel, and we could handle the failure of another small investment bank.
You know, what's so interesting about this is the discussion in both in academia and in central banking circles, which is that the standard view was that the too big to fail problem was a banking problem. And there was tremendous focus on banks. And when we talk about systemically important institutions, they typically were always banks. What is now recognized, and in fact, in terms of the scale, in terms of actually the asset size of Bear, for example, it was not huge. So from that viewpoint, I think that there was an issue about understanding what systemic means. And clearly this crisis has made us recognize that systemic is a lot broader. Who would have thought that an insurance company could pose a systemic risk that was very serious to the entire financial system, and yet that's exactly what happened with AIG. So one of the issues I think that's very relevant here is that one of the things we've learned from this crisis is that we have to think much more broadly about what's a systemic institution and what isn't. And it's not just size. Interconnectedness is extremely important. And in fact, one of the big problems in terms of Bear was how interconnected it was. And also we saw that when Lehman Brothers went under, its interconnectedness showed how spread throughout the system, the world system, in a way that was very disastrous. So there's quite a lot of learning that we have to do.
Okay. When you think about interconnectedness for Bear, which markets do you think about? Do you think about this in terms of strictly pecuniary contracts between Bear and its counterparties, correlation between its asset book and others?
I think that for all of these, I think the issue with the counterparties is extremely important. And then one of the things that we learned in this crisis is how correlated things. One of the huge mistakes that the markets made, and also this is not just the markets, it's in terms of regulation, that we didn't understand how correlated things could get. So, for example, the Basel standards, in terms of the VAR-type calculations, that there was not enough recognition that, although during normal times, asset returns tend to be uncorrelated in different asset classes, when there's a systemic crisis, they all of a sudden become correlated. And that it produces a disaster. And that's actually, again, a very important lesson from a regulatory viewpoint about this crisis, that the way that we typically thought about doing prudential regulation and supervision was on the micro side, that you basically have agencies that go in and make sure that an individual institution is not taking excessive risk. But what we have now realized is that even if individual institutions by themselves have not taken excessive risk, if they're all doing it and there's more correlation between what happens to each one of them with the others, then what looks like a safe bet becomes actually an unsafe bet. And clearly this is also an issue in terms of why the subprime market ended up being such a disaster, that you had financial engineering which created all these new securities which were slicing and dicing risk, and creating what looked like very, very risk-free securities, these AAA tranches of CDOs, for example. And given the correlations that people had seen in the past, which were the correlations were not that strong, so for example, when one person didn't default on a mortgage, it was typically because of unemployment, but if unemployment is bad in one state, it usually isn't bad in another, became very clear is that when housing prices fell nationally, and at such a magnitude that, in fact, the defaults now became correlated. None of that was built into the models that people were building. So a AAA trans security turned out to be very risky indeed. So this was a problem both in terms of the Basel standards, the VAR calculations, this was just plain mistake. I should mention that, you know, one of the causes of this crisis is people just made mistakes. To put it crudely, this happens. That's just fraud. A lot of these very fancy models didn't recognize that the world might not be the way it was in the past. And that's very important too.
Yeah. In the spirit of that, I want to just go back one second back to this interesting discussion that we had about repo. And the idea that collateralized lending turned out to all the counterparty risk effectively mattered all of a sudden in what people thought was a purely collateralized lending market. Did we not know that non-traditional assets were now being used in the repo market? So that as you pointed out, right, in the case of a systemic event, everybody would sell, they'd be fire sales, and people would not be compensated. Or do we not understand that equilibrium, or do we not understand that collateral has sort of snuck into the market, or both?
No, I think people had, people were aware of what the collateral was. Repo transactions are very straightforward. I should say CDOs are not. They're not straightforward at all. And one of the problems with the CDO market is that, in a sense, by getting things so complicated, it may have actually decreased information in the marketplace rather than making it more efficient. And that was a big, big problem.
Sure.
But the repo transactions are very straightforward. People know exactly what collateral they have. So it's not that there's a surprise there. The problem was that everybody thought the collateral was really good. As they say, that people buying these AAA tranches of securities thought that these things were very, very safe. Otherwise, they would never have bought them at the prices they bought them at. So nobody goes out to buy securities and wants to overpay. The world doesn't work that way.
No, it
was just a lack of understanding.
Yeah, no, I was struck. This is similar to the theme when we first started this conversation about the originate-to-distribute model, and that fundamentally it has a series of agency conflicts.
Right.
Akerlof told us in 71 that there are agency conflicts in lots of markets, but market participants tend to find the market develops mechanisms to solve the problem, third-party verification, right?
In fact, the way I put this, I have a whole chapter on my textbook on this. And in the textbook, what I talk about is exactly this. I talk about Akerlof, and here are the agency problems. How do we understand financial structure? It's attempts to solve these problems. The problem is that when you get new innovations, they frequently don't solve them properly at first. Eventually, they will. And you can see that there's tremendous changes in the way things are being done now, that securitizations are now requiring people to originate to have more skin in the game. Why? Because that creates better incentives for them to make sure that it gets paid back. So we're seeing exactly this process of the way to think of financial development is two steps forward, one step back. Unfortunately, sometimes the one step back is pretty damn painful.
And that's
a lot of what we saw here.
So I should think about this, that market participants, in your view, market participants understood their agency problem, and they developed maybe the generation, the version 1.0 market mechanisms to solve those problems, the information asymmetries and the like. They just weren't robust. They weren't sufficient for these new innovations in this generation.
No, I wouldn't quite characterize it that way, because although they thought they were solving some agency problems, there were other ones they just didn't think about. And again, this is the issue that when you have something new, you don't always completely get it right. What was so sad in this case is that when you had these new innovations with these agency problems, you also had a lot of other things going on that were fueling the fire. So although I do not think that our current account deficits were the cause of the crisis, that there would not have been a problem from them if, in fact, we did not have at the same time these new innovations with agency problems weren't solved. When you actually have these kind of agency problems which people had not yet figured out and a huge amount of liquidity, that's when you get into trouble. And that's very much the history of financial crises, that you see there are times when people come up with new products and they don't quite get it right, but there's not the other conditions are not there. So what happens is they make mistakes and then they fix it and they get it right. So you know we've seen this. Let me give you an example of this. Financial innovation has been very successful and now very standard are junk bonds. When they first were developed, there were some problems. This became clear with the Michael Milken episode. But it happened at a time when other problems were not there. So as a result, they fixed them. And that we have a very differently organized junk bond market than we had before. So the bad luck is when you have these agency problems, people didn't quite understand them. So it's not that you don't, as a theoretical matter, say, oh, there are agency problems and we need to solve them. That's well and good, but the details really matter. And it sometimes takes a fair amount of time to get the details right. One of the problems, and I think that's important here, is that when you have mistakes, like one view is we want to prevent all mistakes. And we want to regulate them out of existence. Well, if you do that, you don't get financial innovation, and that could be very harmful to the health of the economy. So, as I said, the initial development of joint stock corporations, one of the great financial innovations, which without it we could not have the kind of wealth we have today, turned out to be a disaster if you regulated it out of existence and said we cannot allow this kind of entity because we had a problem like the South Sea bubble. If that were the case, we would be much worse off. So the problem here is always you have to recognize that you want to do regulation and supervision to make sure that the financial system is healthy, but you do have to worry about trade-offs. You don't want it to prevent financial innovation that actually can help not only businesses do better, but actually democratization of credit is actually something that we want to have poor people have access to credit the way rich people do, as long as the access to credit is not putting them in a situation where they don't have enough information so that they end up getting involved in loans which they can never repay and losing their houses and all the terrible things that can happen to them.
So which information asymmetries do we just not see or not set up, you know, market mechanisms? So,
but we surely did not understand how serious this originate-distribute market was in the subprime market, that's for sure. That we did not understand how what the incentives were, for example, for many mortgage brokers that encouraged them to engage in either not asking for information that really needed to be provided in order to verify whether the person could actually pay back the loan, and to outright fraud, this falsification of documents that were a serious issue. The fact that no doc loans, which actually some cases no doc loans actually can make sense. What I be careful that not that there should be no doc, but they might have different types of documentation. This is a big issue, for example, that when I was at the Federal Reserve, that people from the immigrant community on our Consumer Advisory Council said, standard documentation may not be possible for certain kind of small businesses, but other documentation is going to be very necessary to make sure that the person really is qualified for a loan. But we don't want to have a rule that doesn't prevent you from making a loan to a small business when in fact they certainly have the ability to repay and can show that they have the ability to repay. So this is one of the huge problems thinking about how to do regulation properly. It is a terrifically complex problem. And we're clearly learning a lot in this episode. But the reality is you never completely get it right. And that's just the nature of financial development and the trade-offs. And if we can all make sure we have zero risk, But on the other hand, zero risk society is not one that actually grows very rapidly. So it's a fine line, and in fact, it's one I think that the regulators are dealing with right now. It's one of the things that I, as an academic, are thinking about very hard. We really learned a lot from this crisis, which will help us in preventing some future potential crises. But there's still always going to be problems out there. We may miss some of them. In fact, this is one of the reasons why we have to think about how to get a more secure system in case a financial disruption occurs again, so that we don't have some of the problems. This is one of the reasons why I say the resolution authority is so critical to have it. There are a lot of details here that I'm not completely familiar enough with every aspect of this in the Dodd-Frank bill, but we really do need to get it right.
Professor Mitchin, this is Art Walmarth. I appreciate your taking the time to talk with us. Certainly our effort is not, as I think you quite appropriately indicated, to point fingers at anybody. But we're certainly trying to look back and say, are there warning signs, are there markers that regulators should have missed, that market participants should have noticed? And one that strikes me is the LTCM Russian crisis, because it seems to me, looking back at that, you had high leverage, you had high opacity, you had high correlation, you had herding, and you had a sudden disruption that fortunately was prevented from getting very bad. But it seems to me in miniature, the LTCM Russian crisis resembles very much what happened. And so why do you think that regulators and market participants didn't take that episode more seriously? And
well, they certainly did. And what you see is actually what was remarkable in this episode is that everybody was worried about the hedge funds. The hedge funds were not the problem in this episode. And part of the reason is because the way hedge funds were structured changed after LTCM, because there was recognition that there were some problems in terms of the way hedge funds were operating. And actually, the markets then insisted that hedge funds provide certain information in ways that were different, had the involvement of their principals in different ways. So this is the part of the way that markets actually solved the problem. Were there clearly markers beforehand? Well, ex post, as sure as hell were. That we know that we are now much more aware that rapid credit growth of the type that we saw before this crisis can be dangerous. I'm actually writing a paper right now on exactly this topic for the annual conference of the annual central bank conference that the ECB runs every year, which is lessons that we have to learn about monetary policy strategy. And clearly an issue that's very important is that when you see rapid credit growth, we actually have to worry much more about the fact that there could be these agency problems and externalities that could cause serious difficulties. And there are steps that we might want to take. So this is very much the whole flavor of thinking about macroprudential supervision, that we might want, that there are all sorts of issues in terms of thinking about this, that we might want to have capital requirements which rise for during periods when credit booms are occurring, when there's rapid growth of credit, that we actually think that we should have higher capital standards for firms that are too big or too interconnected to fail. So clearly one of the lessons from this crisis was that capital was not sufficiently high, and this was particularly a huge problem in terms of the investment banking industry. And so were there markers? Sure, there were markers, but they were easy to see after the fact than before the fact. And this is, again, the issue, which is that when you have, if the markers were obvious to everybody, then the crisis never would have occurred. It's the same issue about bubbles. If people all recognize that after prices are out of rapid fundamentals, they know they're going to come down, well, then people aren't going to pay those prices.
Well, my point on LTCM was, I agree that hedge funds changed, but it seems to me that investment banks, at least some of the universal banks, became a lot more like hedge funds, and you see this rush to increasingly opaque instruments. I mean, one thing.
Well, I agree that one of the elements here was that people thought that they were smarter than they actually were, that they thought they understood risk better than they were. But also, I think that there's a problem that and this is an issue that we now realize we have to worry about during credit booms and periods like this, that when everybody's making a lot of money, that the risk management part of businesses may not given enough authority to rein in excessive risk taking, because they're the guys that basically are taking the punch bowl away from the party just when the party's getting good. So I think that this is clearly a very important issue, that one of the things that we as supervisors need to certainly worry about is whether the risk management function is sufficiently strong in organizations. Certainly they certainly were not during this run up. So do I think that LTC that everybody should have known once LTCM occurred? I think that people basically said there was an LTCM problem, the hedge funds are operating differently. Was it a warning sign? Well, you know, I guess the way I would view this right now is that, to me, it's not so much the LTCM issue that was the warning thing that we should have been much more aware of. It was this fact that we had an extremely rapid rate of credit growth with very rapid increases in asset prices. And that was the flag that really should have made us be much more concerned about this. In fact, I should tell you that I had done a lot of work on crises in emerging market countries and talked about exactly these phenomena as being the dangers. But we had this complacency that it can't happen here, that's only a phenomena of countries that have bad institutions, and that's the problem in emerging market countries. Well, it turns out it's a serious problem here as well.
Yes, I think one of the stunning things that jumped out at me when I looked at some of the flow of funds reports was that private sector debt on a nominal basis, and this was during a low inflation period, so nominal is not so far off from reality, went from about $10 trillion in 1991 to $40 trillion in 2007, and about 20 of that 30 upsurge happened in the last 7 years. Were there any discussions at the Fed that, my gosh, you know, credit, and it was all concentrated in the financial and household sectors, most of it. These aggregates are just rocketing, and, you know, this looks like the 1920s again, where you had this.
Well, I think there certainly were always issues of worrying about whether credit spreads were too low, because another thing that was very characteristic period was credit spreads fell to very, very low levels. I think, again, another lesson there was a view that if you just stabilize the economy appropriately, that you did your job properly on price stability and output stability, which is, of course, the dual mandate that the Federal Reserve has, that the markets would take care of themselves and that would lead to a more stable environment. In fact, we saw this period of the Great Moderation where output volatility in the business cycles became very muted. Which, by the way, is a good thing, but one of the issues that we now recognize is that could create problems in and of itself, that when everybody assumes that there's no risk, that could be dangerous. So one of the important lessons here is that pursuit of price and output stability does not ensure financial stability. And that's, I think, extremely important.
Sort of interesting follow-up to that. I mean, that also, of course, resembles the 1920s, that there was a feeling the Fed was actually getting it right, you know, 1924, 1927, by heading off many recessions, and people got greedy. But there is this question that's been raised, and maybe I'll put it this way. Do you think, looking back, going back primarily to Chairman Greenspan's tenure, all the way back to the 87 crash, that the markets began to believe that there was essentially an asymmetric risk policy? In other words, the Fed would not really act aggressively to prick bubbles, but they would act aggressively in response to bursting bubbles to establish some kind of floor of stability. So market participants began to think that there was a limited downside and an unlimited upside, and so then people began reaching further and further for risk in this environment. Do you think that's a possible interpretation of how they view it?
I think that has an element of truth, but I think it can be a pushed too hard. That again, if you're thinking in terms of just pursuing price and output stability, view that, in fact, that a central bank should not lean against bubbles because it can't really know that they're occurring, but clean instead, which is really what people call the Greenspan doctrine, it makes a lot of sense. There is a danger from such a doctrine in that it looks like it has an asymmetric aspect to it, and therefore that people underestimate the risk that there is actually to the system. That because it may be that because what we've seen is that cleaning up is not always so easy to do. Again, that's another lesson. Cleaning up is a big mess and much worse than we anticipated, and that central bank tools, for example, conventional monetary policy, became at some point ineffective when, in fact, the shock was so big because it overwhelmed things, and, in fact, interest rates needed to be driven below zero, and that can't happen in order to contain the shock.
So, Is there a possibility that you clean up smaller bubbles, which, you know, one could look at the 98 episode and the 2001 and 2 episode as, you know, cleaning up after, you know, smaller bubbles that burst, that finally, you know, you encourage the creation of such a large bubble that then it gets beyond your capacity to clean it up
easily? So I think that there certainly is an issue here that it may create a problem to some extent. On the other hand, I think it's also very important to recognize that the Greenspan doctrine did not mean that investors were protected against bursting bubbles. That in fact, bursting bubbles mean huge losses to them. So let me give you an example. Let's think of the tech bubble. So the Federal Reserve, there were issues in terms of the tech sector going wild ex post. We now know it was a bubble, and when it burst. The Federal Reserve did take aggressive actions to make sure that the overall economy did not go into a big tailspin. And in fact, the recession in 2001 was a very mild one. But ask yourself, what happened to investors in the tech sector? They got killed. So the problem that I have with this argument is that it's taken too far. So it's not that there isn't an issue, and it actually, I think, leans us against thinking that just cleaning up is the only thing that central banks should do, that I think there now is a much stronger argument that central banks, both through macroprudential supervision and even possibly sometimes monetary policy, should lean against not asset price bubbles, but credit bubbles.
Right, right.
Because as you might know, I have research and speeches that I made that indicated that the problem with the standard view of leaning against bubbles is that there are two kinds of bubbles. There are bubbles which are very dangerous and ones that aren't. And the ones that are much less dangerous and are easy to clean up after are, in fact, irrational exuberance bubbles. It's the credit bubbles that are really important. And I think that there's actually a convergence of views on this. That I'm writing this paper. I'm moving away from the view which I had, which was very much consistent with the Greenspan-type doctrine. And I've moved away from this even, when I was at the Federal Reserve, saying, no, the Greenspan doctrine really should not be one that says we should have laissez-faire to potential bubbles when, in fact, they're credit-driven. And indeed, I think the right way to think about this is that we don't want to lean against asset prices. We want to lean against credit booms. And actually, what's interesting is that Bill White, who is someone, I don't know if you talked to him, but he was one of the people who, at the BIS, who was very adamant that the bubbles were a big problem. His recent research has actually very much converged to positions that I now have. We're both converging towards each other, where instead of him focusing on leaning against bubbles, he's now talking about leaning against credit booms. That's something that I would argue is one of the lessons that we've learned from this crisis, and actually involves changes in how we think about policy.
One question which is interesting that you raised about the response to dot-com telecom bust. I mean, it's interesting reading back in the speeches that were given at that time, both by Chairman Greenspan and also by now Chairman Bernanke and others, how serious the concerns about deflation were, and how aggressive the response was. And then, interestingly, Chairman Greenspan starts to give speeches in late 2002 through early 2004, where he's telling Congress, look, you know, we've cut interest rates way down. We've cut mortgage rates down to the lowest they've been, you know, since the 1950s. And look, you know, we're seeing housing prices going up. We're seeing sales and starts going up. We're seeing people extracting equity from their homes to support consumption. And it begins to make you believe that the Fed really quite deliberately thought, you know, we've got to somehow create wealth in the housing sector to offset this $8 trillion of paper wealth that disappeared in the tech bust. I mean, do you think that that's actually part of the story, or do you think that that was just something that Mr. Greenspan was noticing and figured that it was helpful to point out?
Well, I think this is an issue that the Federal Reserve was pursuing its dual mandate, which it was pursuing its mandate of price stability and maximum sustainable employment. You know, I have to tell you that one thing I think is underappreciated is that many of the people who are very critical of actions that were taken by policymakers of many stripes, but including the Federal Reserve, that if the Federal Reserve had actually announced the policy of trying to restrain the housing market, either by raising rates or by actually promoting regulation to rein in these issues of subprime mortgages, there would have been a tremendous amount of screaming and yelling from Congress, because there would have been a view of how can you interfere with the democratization and credit and so forth. I think that this is actually something that's underappreciated, that the politics of the housing market, for example, were ones where it actually helped lead to Fannie and Freddie, as I pointed out, but also I think made it much more difficult for policymakers to rein things in if they had wanted to. Now, it's not clear that they did want to, because the prevailing thinking at the time was just worry about worry about output and inflation. That's what we worry about. And I think that there's now a much greater recognition that we have to worry about financial stability as well, and the systemic issues that that have come to the fore. So, you know, ex post, we're clearly in a very different kind of thinking than we were ex ante. And that's one of the things I'm writing about right now.
The political pushback issue is very interesting to us, because I noted, and you probably saw it just recently, that three of the five largest UK banks basically announced they would move out of the UK if the UK were to go through with some kind of narrow bank requirement, separating so-called utility from casino banking. And certainly there seems to have been this very aggressive competition between New York and London during the time that you were on the Fed. Did you get the sense, you know, on the Supervision Regulation Committee and on the Consumer Committee that to the extent the Fed actually was thinking about, you know, pushing back against the housing bubble, that there was a huge opposition from industry and this notion that, well, we can ship more of our stuff to London if you guys get tough with us?
No, I don't think this is an issue, at least that I was being talked about. There was no issue that we're thinking of, gee, we have to keep American banks competitive vis-a-vis foreigners. I just this is not a discussion that I certainly heard about. And in fact, I've always been somewhat worried about these kind of issues. You know, that as regulators, our job is to make the system safe and sound, and that was the concern that we were focused on. But also, you don't want to make the system inefficient either. So, but on the other hand, if you have financial institutions that are doing things that are making the system safe and unsound, and in other countries and you basically want to stop them from doing that, and other countries are saying, gee, we're not going to stop them from doing it because we'll get more business here, you still have to do your job and make sure that they don't engage in those kind of activities. So there's no sense from my perspective that our concern was how do we make sure that banks are, that, you know, New York is competitive with London. I am a New Yorker, but luckily I'm an academic, so not that it directly worried about those kind of issues. But I just don't sense that that was a big deal. I think that certainly in Congress it was a big deal. And of course, there's no question that as I said, you know, I remember when we put in these guidance for commercial real estate lending, and there was a lot of screaming and yelling by the bank. I sat in meetings with bankers where they yelled and screamed at us. And my view was that this is the right thing to do. And by the way, the situation would have been much worse if we hadn't put in that kind of guidance. So I think that there is an issue about political pressure and so forth, and it can affect you. But on the other hand, you try to do your job properly. But you know, we do have to recognize that any government agency is still has to deal with the political environment and does the best job that it possibly can. You know, look, the Federal Reserve was very out in front on the problems in terms of Fannie and Freddie, and Greenspan made speeches on this. It was considered very controversial. In fact, one of the things that actually ended up costing me a lot of money was that I had securities that were completely legal for me to hold when I went to the Fed. They were actually just Ginnie Mae guaranteed securities, but not issued by Ginnie Mae or any GSE. And I was told, "Can you please divest them because we're involved in very controversial stuff, criticizing these people, and we don't want you to have it on your balance sheet and reported in the press." So you know, the answer here is, I think that you try to do the best job that you possibly can. But clearly, the political environment and also the cultural environment matters. There was a
hello.
That he had a lot of influence on taking on this, which is that the markets basically solve problems and they'll solve the problems. And of course, Greenspan's testimony said that was one of his mistakes. But we now recognize that the financial markets needed more regulation than they did previously, that we did not get that right. And now we have to think about how do we get that regulation right and yet still make sure that this market stay efficient. And as I said, you know, I'm part of a working group that's been discussing exactly these issues and presenting its findings to Congress and publishing its work in order to try to think about how to improve regulation so we are less likely to have the kind of crisis that we have.
One more question on supervisory policy, because there were quite serious problems, we know, obviously, in Citigroup and Wachovia, but one of the things that seems to have been true was that the Fed and, to some extent, the OCC at least seem to have indicated that they didn't think they could do much, you know, with the broker-dealer subsidiaries where obviously some of these riskier activities were occurring. And that raises this whole issue of consolidated supervision.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, I've read some of the things going back to Graham Leach Bliley and the GAO's report that came out in 2007, and a lot of the stuff that's sort of said in those reports and those statements were that, in fact, you know, the Fed and to some extent the OCC were very focused on consolidated supervision, and that it wasn't a seamless process, but it mattered to them. And they realized that the business activities were going on across corporate subsidiaries.
Right.
Those silos didn't mean anything in terms of how the business was run. And yet now, in retrospect, we're told, well, we really didn't think we could do much with the broker-dealer subsidiaries. And I'm just a little curious as to why that attitude may have persisted.
Yes, this is an area where I'm really not expert enough because it involves a lot of legal issues. So I have to tell you, when I sat in the Stoop and Red Committee, that there were frequently, there were some meetings where there was so much legal jargon going on, it was like, and boxes and everything else, I didn't understand what, you know, it was very hard to figure out exactly what the issues were. There were some really subtle legal issues here, and I just do not have that level of expertise. That my research has been very much on the big think aspects, in terms of, particularly in terms of monetary policy, but also in terms of regulatory policy. But a lot of these details really matter a tremendous amount. What jurisdiction you have, what's legal and what isn't, how do you interpret things. This is why I don't know how big our legal staff at the board is, but it's pretty substantial. On that kind of issue, I really can't comment, but I just don't have the expertise.
Okay.
Thank you.
One question, just going back to Bayer, and I'd just like to hear a little bit about your last 6 months at the Fed, which were really an interesting period between Bayer and Lehman.
Right.
I mean, what was the atmosphere then? Was the Fed kind of getting the feeling, or policymakers getting the feeling that something bigger could happen? And what were they doing? What were they doing differently to prepare?
The way I would describe it, certainly remember that after Bayer, the Fed was taking a lot of very aggressive action in terms of facilities and lowering interest rates during that period. So that we were clearly aware that there were potential problems. But I have to tell you, one of the very interesting things that occurred during this crisis, which is where we were basically, and when I say we, I'm talking about the general central bankers everywhere, and in the profession, where there was by the summer of 2008, just before I left, a lot of people were saying, look, you know, this crisis has been ongoing for a while, but it looks like we've contained it, we've got these facilities, and in fact, many central banks were talking about, gee, our big problem is inflation and we have to raise rates. So you saw a lot of discussion of that, by the way, in speeches by FOMC participants. The problem was that things were, the rot in the system was a hell of a lot worse than any of us expected. And, personally, to say that I took financial disaster was an understatement. I bought a new house building a new house, which I bought the property in the end of February of 2008. And then got stuck with two houses and not being able to sell my old house, and which is a disaster. If I had been able to, if I had known that things would get so bad, believe me, the last thing I would have done was to be sitting there with two more houses.
Right.
So, and I can't tell you about what I did with my investments. I lost half my pension during this process as well, because of a rule that the Federal Reserve had, which made me take my pension completely out of Treasury index securities, and I put it into global equities. So, you know, the answer here is that there really were big surprises. The view, I think, was that we had some real problems. We've been very aggressive to deal with it. It looks like we're going to be able to scrape by with a nasty recession, but not a great recession. That the financial system looks like we may have it contained. But on the other hand, that clearly that was not the case, and if we had a crystal ball, boy, would we, you know, listen, personally, I would have done some things very differently. Let me put it this way. I wouldn't have had the stress that I had after I came back to the Fed and I was sitting there with disaster, the aspects of things that I had to deal with and concerned about personal affairs. So I think this is just the reality of being in a situation with where this sort of set of events all comes together to create this rogue wave, and boy, you get hit by the 100-foot wave. And in this case, the good news is we got hit by a 100-foot wave, but our ship didn't sink. It stayed afloat. It just got pretty badly rocked up and damaged. So that's the good news. The bad news is that we still took an awfully big hit.
When we took that hit, in particular in Q3 and Q4 of 2008, and what was effectually a financial crisis turns
virulent,
hits the real economy very hard, right? So we have a 6.4% annualized decline in GDP in Q4.
Is that the result? I mean, is this, in your view, is that, are those wealth effects? Is that panic? Is that a credit crunch from the credit intermediation having gone away?
It's exactly what you see in financial crises. It's classic. That once the system really seizes up, then you have a collapse in asset prices that hits wealth. You have asymmetric information problems in the credit markets explode. So as a result, credit spreads shoot through the roof, which makes it more costly for people to borrow. And then the third thing that happens is that with greater asymmetric information problems, that even with the same interest rates, people are not going to be willing to lend. So in fact, I have a new chapter. I'm writing a new macroeconomics textbook, and I discuss exactly these kind of phenomena and how do we understand when we have financial crisis. Why we always see the following, which is something I had written about for years, which is the worst financial contractions are always associated with financial crises.
But do we have a sense of the relative magnitudes across those, or does it not matter as to which effects dominate, because they all seem to happen?
Well, they all seem to happen once, but I think that the most serious of the effects are what's going on in the credit market. So the stock market is always the sideshow. And that's why, for example, why when you have a stock market crash, which we've had many of them throughout history, most stock market crashes do not lead to serious impacts on the economy. Do they cause a contraction in aggregate demand? Sure they do. But they're usually fairly easy to deal with in the sense of the cleanup works, because they're basically linear. So, you know, you have a loss in wealth, you cut back spending, but then you can have both fiscal and monetary authorities pursue expansionary policy that overcomes that. And that's sort of the typical case. What is much more serious is when the credit market frees up, that's when really bad things happen.
Hey, it's Dave here, and, you know, we've gone over our time a little bit. Yep. I know Professor Mishkin has some family obligations. I didn't know if you guys had a last...
I hope this is... I do actually have somebody coming right now, so this would be a great time to break, if we could.
Yeah, this was meant to be sort of, you know... So I think a closing question, you know, is this transition from this vicious financial crisis to really understanding, because again, our job is to explain to the American people why it is you guys are so concerned about saving the markets,
right,
and the institutions.
So the key thing I would say on this, the last thing is, it's not the stock market. That's it has some effects, but the key is the credit market.
And specifically,
low credit market, you got big problems.
Specifically, in this case, was it the commercial paper market that was the biggest concern?
It's all the credit markets. It's the fact that the shadow banking system basically closed up. The banking system closed up. It's basically looking for the individual part of it really doesn't make sense, because they're all interconnected.
Mm-hmm. If I will intrude on your goodwill just for one last question, and you could choose to send us something by email if you'd like, but the one question I have which relates to everything you've said is that one thing that struck me very much throughout this crisis is there were repeated efforts to try to get rid of the toxic assets through the MLEC, through the PPIP, and other things, and we've never done it. The toxic assets have never been priced, have never been disposed of. There's been no good bank, bad bank approach, anything like that. And the question I'm asking is, are the toxic assets indeed much larger and much worse than anyone has known or quantified? And my related question, and this is more looking toward what might happen in the future, I agree very much with you. I think the Fed did everything that it had to do in this crisis. I mean, that we had to avoid a Great Depression. But one question that bothers me for the future is, I think eventually the Fed became the market maker of last resort for all the toxic assets nobody else wanted. And is the takeaway from this crisis for the market that in the future, if we get this terrible concentration of toxic assets in the future, the Fed will once again be the market maker of last resort, which again creates, in my view, an asymmetric, you know, risk problem. I don't know if you thought about that, but...
Yeah, this was a tough one, but I think that part of the issue here is that... In many other cases, when you've seen some problems occur, The government has, so for example, you look at the Sweden case, the Swedish government was actually able to separate assets into bad banks and good banks and basically use fiscal resources to basically clean this up. We did the same, by the way, though it took a long time to do it in the savings loan crisis.
Mm-hmm.
But it got so bad because the government wouldn't deal with it. And one of the heroes of that situation was the first George Bush, who in very early in his administration, the first thing he did in his administration was he finally dealt with a problem that neither the Congress or the previous administration were willing to deal with, which was cleaning up the S&Ls, and actually allocated $150 billion in order to do so, and that actually produced legislation. Actually, that's a period where the federal government and regulators did a really good job. The Fiducia Act in 1991, so they did it really very, very well. 1989, they did called the FERIA Act, which basically gave resources to actually clean up the S&L mess and create bad banks and allocate the good assets so they could sell off all these bad assets and get the system restarted again. And in that legislation, very smartly, they said, look, we did the bailout, but now what we need to do is we need to actually try to prevent this from happening again, and actually put in very important and very successful legislation, the Fiducia legislation 91, which if we had not had it, and this happened in this case, I think then the likelihood of a depression would have been much, much higher. Because Fiducia substantially improved the amount of capital in banking institutions and was a major positive step that helped us actually weather not only not have as bad a situation currently, but also made the 2000-2001 episode much less severe than it otherwise would have been. But on the other hand, it still wasn't enough given what happened. And hopefully we'll get the new legislation that's been passed, and a lot of it's in the devil's in the details, will improve the system, and that we're going to need to do more. So this is sort of our homework assignment. So hopefully that's one of the things you can come out with in your report, that we let's stop blaming everybody and let's get to work to try to fix the problems to make the system more stable, and that there have been successful periods of improving things. And a sort of a classic example of actually the government actually getting it right was 89 through 91. There are periods when they've been horrendous, but let's hope we can actually move in the right direction. So I have to go.
We right. want to
so thank you very,
thank
very
you.
Much.
Thank you.
That was very helpful. We really appreciate your time today.
No, my pleasure. Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you, Professor.
Thank you, David.
All right. See you guys.
Talk to you later.